It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Coming up, we meet a Wisconsin-born jazz musician whose latest album comes out tomorrow. It's called Spark.
First, the Marquette Law School released a new poll today that surveyed Wisconsinites on a variety of topics, from their first choice for a presidential nominee to their feelings on the state's 20-week abortion ban.
The poll sampled more than 800 registered Republican and Democratic voters from around the state in order to create a snapshot of the views of Wisconsin voters.
This is the school's first political poll since April, and a lot has changed. Since then, Governor Walker officially joined the presidential race, and Donald Trump's popularity as a candidate has exploded.
Joining us now is Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School Poll and professor of law and public policy at Marquette University. He's also the co-founder of Pollster.com and founder of PollsandVotes.com. Charles, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
So according to this most recent poll, 25% of voters who are or lean Republicans say Governor Walker is their choice for the presidential nomination. How has that changed since April?
Well, back in April, it was at 40%, so it's come down quite a bit. Now, as you said, a lot has changed. Donald Trump wasn't even in the race in April, and Ben Carson has gone from 5% in April to 13% now. Finally, back in April, a lot of the candidates weren't officially announced or were just testing the waters. So it's not surprising that we see a good bit of change, but it's also striking that aside from Walker and Carson, every other candidate is in single digits. We're really seeing a wide spread of support across the field.
So we discussed earlier in the program that Governor Walker's national poll numbers are declining. Why do you think he is slipping both nationally and in Wisconsin?
Well, I think part of it is competition from other candidates. He started off with a breakout performance in late January and followed that up with rising poll numbers in Iowa and nationally. But starting in the late spring, we saw his numbers start to decline as other candidates got in the race and divided the vote more. It's fair to point out that that's also true of other candidates like Marco Rubio, who had a rise and a fall, and Chris Christie, who's been sliding for some time. But having said all of that, the more recent developments, of course, are the Donald Trump phenomena in national polling. Here, Trump only polled at 9%, so he's not the breakout figure here in Wisconsin, at least as of now, that he has become in some other states and in the national polls.
So let's look at the Democratic side. Hillary Clinton is in front with 44% of the vote. Has that changed much since your last survey?
There, too, it's dropped off from 58% in April to 44% now. But here the change of candidates is, if anything, even more dramatic. In April, Bernie Sanders wasn't even in the race. He's now in and getting 32% support. Also, back in April, we asked about Elizabeth Warren, who has since made it clear that she's not running. And so she got 14% back in April and now is out of the race altogether. The one constant is Vice President Biden, who gets 12% in both April and in this new August poll. The other Democratic candidates are all at 1% or below.
So do you think Bernie Sanders might be a credible threat to Hillary Clinton?
Well, at this point, he certainly looks like a credible threat here. You know, at 44 to 32, she's still clearly leading him. But we're still waiting to find out how substantial the Sanders phenomena will be and whether he can maintain it over the course of the fall. And we haven't had a Democratic debate yet and won't for a while. So I think the Democratic race is still in the early stages of shaping up. That said, Sanders is showing some real appeal in Wisconsin among Democratic voters.
So if Hillary Clinton ends up being the ultimate Democratic nominee, do you have a sense from this latest poll how she would fare against top Republicans that are in the field?
She's leading against all four Republicans we tested this time. ranging from a 5-point lead over Jeb Bush, 10 points over Walker, 12 points over Ted Cruz, and 16 points over Donald Trump. Those numbers show Clinton with everything from a slight edge at 5 points to a pretty substantial edge. But all of those numbers are a bit tighter than they were when we asked about three of those candidates back in April. We did not ask about Trump in April. And so you see the race tightening a bit by 2 or 3 or 4 percentage points.
Another election that will be coming up is for the U.S. Senate seat that is currently held by Ron Johnson. He is being challenged by former Senator Russ Feingold. Who's leading in that contest, according to your poll?
Well, there it's tightened a good deal. Feingold has 47% to Johnson's 42% in this poll. In April, when we asked about the race, was shortly after Feingold announced that he would run. And at that point, Feingold had 54% to Johnson's 38%. So a difference of 16 points has now become a difference of 5 points. That's certainly a substantial tightening of that race.
And we will be actually hearing from Russ Feingold at 3 o'clock tomorrow here on Central Time. Let's look at the approval ratings for what kind of job Governor Walker is doing. How do state residents feel about that?
Well, here he's showing the lowest approval rating in the Marquette poll that we've been doing since January 2012. We only began polling that month, and so we don't have any data from his first year in office from the Marquette poll. But in this poll, he's at 39% approve, 57% disapprove, and that is the worst that we have seen him. Back in April, it was 41 approve, 56 disapprove. So he's just slightly gone down since April. But if we jump back to October, just before the election, it was 49% approval, 47 disapproval. So that's a 10-point decline since October of 14 in approval and a 10-point increase in disapproval over that time.
Is that common, do you feel, when a candidate is running for a higher office? Does their popularity, when they're spending a lot of time maybe out of the state doing other campaign things, does their popularity tend to go down?
It often does, and we're certainly seeing it this year with Governor Christie in New Jersey and Governor Jindal in Louisiana. I have not seen recent polling in Ohio for Governor Kasich, who's otherwise been polling fairly well there. But certainly in our data, we find only 33% of respondents say they like the idea that Walker's running for president. 63% say they don't. Now, of course, that includes a lot of Democrats in the sample who you would not expect to be pleased with him running. But among core Republicans, support is strong. 70% say they like that he's running. Just 28% say they don't.
Charles, thank you so much for joining us today.
Okay. Thank you.
That was Charles Franklin, director of the Marquette Law School poll, giving us the scoop behind the poll's latest findings.
Our next guest is making a name for herself in the world of jazz. Kat Reinert comes from Milton, Wisconsin, and she's also a voice teacher, composer, and touring vocalist. Her fourth album comes out tomorrow on August 21st. It's called Spark. She joins us now to talk about why this album is personal for her.
Your love was like water falling down like the rain. All the spaces that I tried to hide from the pain. Your love was like tomorrow, no need to explain. Well, now we've said goodbye, so I know that I've just gotta walk into the rain. Yeah, now we've said goodbye, so I know that.
The song is called Walk Into the Rain. It's the first track on this album. What do you hear in this song?
A letting go of a lot of pain that I had gone through previous to writing it.
It sounds as though the person, I guess you, that we're talking about, knows that there's some hard stuff going on, but she's also embracing it. You're embracing this and knowing that it's the next step.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. And a friend of mine We were talking about how it was raining the day that I was moving, and it was just the elevator didn't work, my piano couldn't get up, the movers were, and it was pouring, and I called him and I was like, this is crazy. And he said, well, just look at it this way. It's washing away all of the stuff so that you can start fresh. And the rain stopped, the elevator worked, my piano got into my apartment. It was awesome. So that's what inspired this.
What is it like having a song that's sort of this capsule of this particular moment, painful and good, but all of it is sort of held inside this vessel that's the song? Do you think of that every time you hear this?
I do. I remember the exact moment that I probably got inspired to write it, even though I wrote it probably a couple months later. But it is that. It's the letting go and accepting where you're at so that you can move forward from that place.
When did you first know that you wanted to spend the rest of your life singing?
That's an interesting question. I probably about 5 years ago.
5 years ago.
But I've been doing this for the last 25 years.
At some point, though, you realized, like all singers, that you have a voice.
Yeah.
And that it gave you joy to sing.
Yes.
Right? When did that happen?
Probably when I was a little kid. I used to sing around the house. Lately, I've been remembering a lot of things about being a kid, and I would make up songs in the back of the minivan as we were going places and never told anyone. And I sang in high school and in college, and that just, it kind of, I like to think that music sort of found me and helped guide my path a little bit.
And you grew up in Milton, Wisconsin. This is a small town just outside of Janesville. Well, you were growing up there and finding your voice. Did you have mentors along the way that helped you?
No, not in Milton. I didn't even know that you could take a voice lesson until I went to college. And they were like, you're going to take voice lessons. And I said, well, what's that? Like, I already sing. Like, what? Why do you do that? And I had no idea where that one moment would take me in this direction.
So were you doing it under your own steam all these years, keeping this love of singing alive?
No. I mean, when I got into college, then I started having a mentor. My first teacher, Patrice Michaels Betty, at Lawrence University, and then Peter Eldridge when I was at Manhattan School of Music, and different people along the way. Kate McGarry, who's a brilliant jazz singer, she introduced me to something called somatic voice work, and Jeannie Levetri, and that really made a massive difference in the way that I sang and the way that I perceived singing and my entire person as well.
What is somatic voice work?
It is a type of training the voice that is very functionally based. So that's all the science that involves how the vocal folds actually work. But then there's all of the work on your own person that has to come along with that. So when you teach someone, you're helping them discover themselves at the same time they're finding their voice.
Interesting. So it was sort of an emotional journey and a psychological journey, and not just
And then a
physical.
Huge physical. Yeah, exactly. But also, it was a huge physical journey. I actually changed the entire mechanics of how I sang about 7 years ago.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you used to sound?
Not hugely, not a massive amount of difference, but it was less warm, less rich. Definitely, I didn't have as much understanding of the voice, and so couldn't do as much with it. So those kinds of things definitely changed for me.
That's really interesting, because as I listened to you before this interview, I was thinking, I kept hearing the warmth in your voice, the incredible warmth in your voice, and so it sounds like this comes from the specialized work that you've done on your voice.
Yeah, a lot. I think people would notice it. I notice it most because it feels different inside to sing. So, yeah.
Well, tell us about your new album. It's called Spark. What were you trying to do with it?
Put something authentic and wholehearted out into the world that I believe in a creative project that I'm really proud of, and just help people. I think that's always my goal, even as a performer, as a teacher. I like helping people. And I'm hoping that this record might help people find hope or deal with something that's difficult for them, and maybe they don't have the creative outlet that allows them to do that. So,
and you use the word authentic, and in doing that, it seems as though listening through that you do get at some difficult subject areas. You mentioned the pain that came from Walk Into the Rain, and also you using about body insecurities.
Yeah, a lot.
Why did you choose to do that?
I think a lot of women, and myself included, have a lot of misconceptions about what we're supposed to look like, what we're supposed to be like, both negative and positive. And being proud of who you are and the skin that you live in, no matter what it is, you know, it's whether you're skinny or, you know, you feel like you need to lose weight or, you know, like anything in between. Like, I wish we could just accept ourselves and say, hey, pretty awesome, man. Like, your legs work. Like, you can walk down the street. That's pretty awesome. So,
and what song gets at that?
Probably Naked the most of all.
Naked is a lonely place, and naked is forever grace. Humble and human, I found peace. Silky sheets, if you please. Naked is before your eyes, and naked is my secret disguise. 007 past 10, rising up, I'm about to begin and take what I create.
We're talking with Kat Reinert right now, jazz singer from Milton, Wisconsin originally, talking about her new album. It's called Spark. And in this album, critics say that you blend jazz and you also blend the singer-songwriter genre. You're sort of a storyteller here. Do you think that's new territory?
It feels like it. I think there are a lot of really amazing songwriters in the world, and there are a lot of really amazing jazz singers in the world, and you don't find a lot of jazz singers writing original music. And if they do, it's not often lyric-driven. It's very melodic or harmonic-driven, which is beautiful. It's gorgeous music, but it's not always getting to what people who might not listen to jazz might want to listen to a jazz singer for. They want to listen to Ella or Billy or Sarah Vaughan or any of those, because it sounds like what they think it's going to sound like. So I'm hoping.
And you're a teacher yourself now, I understand. You work with students. What do you like about working with young voices?
They're really inspiring. It's inspiring to see someone come into my studio and help them find their voice, not only physically, but also emotionally, and to find them discovering things that they didn't know they could do, and also sounds they didn't know they could make.
And we're going to end by listening to your song, Prison. Let's take a listen.
Alone in a prison made by only you. Can't see an exit, 'cause you've lost your point of view. You tried to break out in the past, but nothing ever seems to last. Hold on. Alone in a prison, the bars are make-believe.
And tell us what prison is about.
Shame. In a word, I am a huge fan of Brené Brown, who does a lot of research on shame. She calls herself a shame researcher, which I think is just awesome. And I've read all of her books, and we want to see vulnerability. She talks about vulnerability and how you want to, it's the first thing you want to see in someone else, but it's the last thing that you want to like give out. And so I think that's a really powerful thing. I think vulnerability is courage, not weakness. So,
and did writing this song help you work through some of those feelings?
It did. It was a fascinating. I mean, that song I actually started writing for someone else and put it away for about a year, and then came back to it, and I said, "Oh my gosh, I was writing this for me. I didn't know that at the time." But yeah, it totally helped me work through a whole lot of stuff. It was great.
Kat, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Kat Reinert. She's a composer, teacher, and a touring jazz musician and singer from Milton, Wisconsin. Her new album is called Spark, and it comes out tomorrow.
Making good on a threat, a hacker group called Team Impact appears to have released the personal information of 37 million users of the site AshleyMadison.com. The information includes names, usernames, addresses, phone numbers, birth dates, and details of credit card transactions, as well as sexual preferences and GPS coordinates. The site is run by Avid Life Media and is marketed for people interested in cheating on their spouses, with the slogan, "Life is short, have an affair."
The hacker group announced that it had stolen the user data last month and threatened to release the entirety of it if the site was not shut down. Well, the site stayed live, and as a result, Team Impact released the information on Tuesday. Early reporting has suggested that the dump is real and has revealed thousands of government email addresses as well as email accounts linked to known individuals.
The company Avid Life Media is working with law enforcement agencies in Canada and the U.S. to investigate the data breach and to remove any information posted unlawfully. Here with us to talk about the world of cyber behavior and relationships is Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Science at UW-Madison. Catalina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
So what exactly was AshleyMadison providing to its many millions of users?
AshleyMadison is a company founded in Canada in 2001, providing people interested in having an affair with an opportunity to connect with other people interested in having an affair and pursuing their mutual interests.
that's a nice way to put it. So obviously, affairs are nothing new. They were certainly going on long before the technological age. How is it different when people are using a site like AshleyMadison?
AshleyMadison creates opportunities for affairs in the sense that they collect people together in one location who are interested in this, making it more easily accessible to people who are interested in having an affair to find potential partners. And it provides discretion, or at least this is their main claim, which is why they're so badly hurt by the data leak. Supposedly, they could offer users the degree of privacy that people usually want in a circumstance like this.
So they're offering efficiency and they're offering anonymity. It turned out that the anonymity certainly didn't pan out. But do you think people who might have had affairs through AshleyMadison might otherwise not have been if they didn't have that kind of a forum or a tool to do that?
That's a fascinating question, and we would need some data to look into that. So far, the data that I've looked at is data regarding infidelity statistics during the past decades or so. And the numbers seem to be pretty consistent, suggesting that the introduction of technology did not necessarily make people have more affairs when they wouldn't have had. And this is actually AshleyMadison's a strong defense. It's they're claiming that their site is not making cheaters. It's just providing a tool to people who would have cheated otherwise.
So that's interesting, though, because if it's just as easy or likely to have an affair offline, the good old-fashioned way, whatever that might be, why would there be 37 million registered users on a site like AshleyMadison?
Yes, that's an interesting question. I think we would need to have some data about what the behavior of those users on the site might be. Some of them likely went on to have affairs face-to-face. Others probably engaged in cyber sex, which doesn't necessarily involve any face-to-face meeting. Others probably went to check their options and to maybe experience a self-esteem boost when going through a rough patch in their relationship. So we really need to look at the behavior of those individual users.
So what do we know about how people use the internet and how it changes their behavior? Do people do things on the internet or present themselves in ways on the internet that they would never do in real life?
Indirect communication does have some interesting effects on behavior, but it never acts alone, right? The internet is the tool that people use to satisfy whatever goals and needs they might have. This being said, research has uncovered a variety of interesting effects. For instance, in the area of self-disclosure, we're finding that people are actually more comfortable talking about themselves under conditions of anonymity. So the internet really does foster increased self-disclosure. On a site like Ashley Madison, this could be interesting because people talk very openly about their sexual fantasies and desires, which may be topics that they might not feel comfortable broaching face to face. So this is an effect that we would likely find. Internet communication also affects the prevalence of deception. We've looked at that in our lab, in lots of our research, but not in the straightforward ways that people might imagine. It's not like the internet just facilitates deception, doesn't just make it easy to lie. It actually provides what we call constraints and also facilitators or enablers of deception. So some of the constraints would be recordability. The majority of people might not choose to lie when there's a record of their deception. Actually, research shows that email is the most honest medium of them all,
really?
Quite contrary to what people say. Other deception enablers might be anonymity because it takes away some of the accountability of deception, or perhaps having a lot of time to think about and compose your lie, which you might not have face to face.
So it's interesting because you said that it can facilitate deception, but we've also seen the internet and forums like this, bringing people together, like-minded people with different kinds of interests. Also, for instance, say kids who are maybe discovering that their sexuality is not something that their parents or their community would support, but they're able to find support and friends and people to talk about that with on the internet. So it seems like there are two sides to a coin, and one can be very positive and one not so much.
Oh, absolutely right. There's a ton of research on the positive effects of the internet, and one that you've just mentioned is this ability to provide social network support to enable individuals to find like-minded individuals. And in many situations, this is incredibly powerful. If you have very niched interests, if your sexuality is not mainstream, for instance, or you're marginalized in some way, and you're able to connect with others similar to yourself, this can be extremely beneficial. But it also, in the case of Ashley Madison, depending on people's moral views, it might be an instance to facilitate behaviors that are deceptive.
I do find it interesting because it really feels like there is a new huge data breach every week, if not more often. There was just a huge IRS data breach, I think, last week. You know, it feels like it's not even news anymore. And the fact that there were people on the site, many millions of people, who felt a level of privacy and security and anonymity that clearly was not the case. What is it about maybe human behavior or human psychology that we can hear about so many instances where things that were supposed to be secure are not, and yet still make a risk like this?
Internet security is a really big topic and extremely important. But if we think about it carefully, we are all giving away parts of our privacy and incredibly personal information to various websites on a routine basis. The internet is so deeply integrated into our everyday lives that sometimes we don't think about it. If it's online shopping and online gaming and a variety of such activities. And you're right, there are instances of data breach, but people have developed a level of trust and also a level of reliance at this point on the internet that sometimes it's difficult to consciously think about the risks of providing this information. And I should say that Ashley Madison as a company really stressed the anonymity and the discretion of their users. So this might be a failing on their side as well, and maybe potentially deceptive advertisement.
We're talking to Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Science at UW-Madison, about the hacking and release of millions of users' personal information from the website ashleymadison.com. The site facilitates cheating on a spouse with the motto, "Life is short, have an affair."
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think the site itself is to blame for affairs? Do you think that it's appropriate that this information obtained illegally has been released to the public? Have you searched the data? Are you concerned about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation with Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Science at UW-Madison, talking about the hacking and release of millions of users' personal information from the website ashleymadison.com. The site facilitates cheating on a partner with the motto, "Life is short, have an affair."
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What's your reaction to the release of users' personal information? Do you think the website is responsible for facilitating affairs? Or maybe you think the users had it coming? Is this a concerning breach of privacy, whether or not we were on the site? We'd love to hear from you at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Well, one of the interesting aspects to this very interesting story, Catalina, was that apparently there were a fair number of users who were using their work email accounts and even working for governments, because it was, you know, I think City of Cleveland had found some addresses, and authorities have been clear to say, you know, people could be spoofing, they could be using someone else's email address, so, you know, let's not jump to conclusions. But I'm guessing that at least some of those were actually people using their work emails to register on this site that facilitates infidelity. What does that say about how people view the ability to be anonymous online? Because it's really easy to set up, say, a Yahoo account or a Gmail account. It's not like that's their only way to access the internet.
Absolutely right. This is one aspect of the story that really baffles me, because it's very unthoughtful and dangerous behavior with potentially very serious repercussions on people's ability to maintain their jobs. But you're right, it says that there's a level of trust in the anonymity of the internet, or a lack of thoughtfulness about what happens to the data once it's provided to one of these web companies.
So what should we, as internet citizens, maybe is a way to put it, you know, whether or not we're going to be going on a site like Ashley Madison, but any site, I mean, what should we be thinking about? Should we be putting ourselves through, you know, a few more layers of thinking about what we're doing before we do anything online?
It is important to exercise thoughtfulness when it comes to the release of personal information, such as, you know, credit card information and bank accounts and things of that nature, because you don't really know what's going to happen to it on the other end. For this reason, it's absolutely critical for companies to build reputations and to build a brand that is credible in attracting and retaining customers in this way. But yes, thoughtfulness is really important. And not to mention that people need to be aware that everything that happens on a work computer or at work is likely visible to a network administrator, and they can be held accountable for it.
Well, and I think also if you're working for, say, the state government or a city government or a university, there's also the possibility of open records requests that your emails could end up being part of a lawsuit or being poured over by who knows who.
Absolutely right. I think about that all the time because I work for the university. All of my private emails could be visible to anybody in the state of Wisconsin. So that's something critical to keep in mind.
So you talked about the importance of businesses to be able to have that credibility, to have trust. So I'm guessing that Avid Life Media is probably
in dire straits.
Do we know what action they're taking to respond to the breach, either legally or, you know, kind of efforts to save face or save the website?
I don't know yet what strategy they have. I'm sure they're working on it and thinking about it very carefully. I think in legal terms, it might be difficult for consumers to file a class action suit and request damages, because they have a high burden of proof in demonstrating that there was significant harm that was created to their life as a result of this breach of data.
Well, not to mention that by filing as a plaintiff, you're saying, "Hello, I was on AshleyMadison.com."
Exactly right. Yep.
So, you know, what does it mean? I think I will admit I had not heard of AshleyMadison.com before this breach. There are probably a lot of people out there who had maybe never heard of it, never thought of this kind of website being out there. you know, what does it do for how people look at the person that they're in a relationship with when they find out that there might be this whole world out there? Maybe they have little concerns, but does that amplify when they know that there are probably a lot of ways to be unfaithful out there that they're not even aware of?
I guess I suppose you have couples who trust each other and couples who do not, and those who do not might experience a new level of fear, worry and paranoia, depending on whether it's true or not, as a result of the proliferation of sites like this.
So obviously there are a lot of sites out there that are above board for meeting people of common interests, as we talked about earlier, or for dating, not for having an affair necessarily, but, you know, for meeting people that you might want to get to know, and it might lead to a long-term relationship. Are situations like what happened with Ashley Madison, with the data breach, with very personal information being put out there, you know, sites like OkCupid or Tinder, where people are doing online dating, should people be thinking twice about using sites like that? Or do you think it's going to have an impact on how people think about those kind of sites?
No, I don't think this is going to have any sort of major impact, not even on sites dedicated to infidelity. It's a blip. It's an error. And even if Ashley Madison, say, as a company doesn't survive, there will be others that provide the service because there's a market. People want it. As for above board dating sites, they're doing really, really well. There's not this moralistic concern that people are doing something wrong. So I guess they experience the same level of risk as any online retailer or any other website where people provide sensitive information. I just don't think that we're going to go back to a time where technology is used less for personal relationships. I think we're going to move into a time where it's used more.
It's certainly become really mainstream and common to meet someone online.
Incredibly common. Online dating is staggeringly successful.
And I think actually people are surprised when they find out a couple didn't meet online, where it used to be the opposite. Yep. Not that long ago.
Yep, yep.
So I think the moral aspect of this is really interesting, because the hackers said that they grabbed the data and they basically said, if you don't shut the site down, we're going to release the data. And there were a couple things. I think the hackers were saying this site is a sham. There were many, many more male users than female, so the chance of actually meeting someone, which was what the advertised service was actually pretty low. There was also, you could pay $19 to completely have your information wiped out, and it turned out that was not happening because there was information that was released. So the hackers were kind of going after the company. But I think there are a lot of people out there who are seeing this news and thinking, well, you know, you were there to cheat on your spouse or your partner, serves you right for getting caught. How does this moralism and you know, calling on ethics come into play in technology in the online world?
Well, two points that you made are really interesting. First, the ethics of the company itself, the business practices, might indeed be problematic. I don't know to what extent this impact team was actually targeting a bad company wanting to bring them down, but it is revealing some of the problematic practices of this company, such as charging consumers for deleting accounts when they were actually not deleting those accounts. So perhaps this is a positive thing that's coming out of this scenario. As for the second aspect, the judgment of others and they had a coming sense of moral outrage, it is to be expected. We've seen it lots of times. It is also a little bit myopic in the sense that people don't realize that if this kind of breach is possible in an infidelity context, it's possible in any context. So we all need to be incredibly worried about the state and fate of our data online.
And so knowing that, is there a recommended amount of information to put online about yourself or to not put online about yourself?
It varies on a case-by-case basis, but people need to be thoughtful about who they're giving the information to, what exactly they're agreeing to what extent they know what's going to happen to the information, and what might be the repercussions if things go badly.
And I think one of the aspects of this that maybe less sophisticated users of technology don't realize is that
we talk a lot about, you know, what you put, say, on your Facebook account, you know, what you say about what your birthday is, and that that can be tied to other things and anniversaries and age and things like that. But that's the public face. There's also a concern about what data you're giving that is supposed to stay private, that is never meant to be shown to the public, but it's still there and it's being captured.
That's an excellent point. And I think people tend to be very liberal in their sharing on both fronts. They tend to share a great deal publicly. They also share privately or with an expectation of privacy. And as we're seeing, that could be problematic sometimes.
If I'm remembering correctly, there was also a situation not that long ago where Snapchat was actually saving photos, and the whole idea of Snapchat is that it's fleeting, that you see the picture, you send the picture to someone, they see it, and then it disappears in 10 seconds. And especially with young people, I think there was a sense of, well, yeah, I'm not going to put pictures of myself, you know, at a party, underage drinking on Facebook, because I know that maybe that'll be found by a future employer, but Snapchat is safe. And it turned out Snapchat wasn't safe.
Yeah, Snapchat is a great example because it emerged as a response to the recordability of the web. Everything we do online leaves traces, and that can be problematic in many instances. People are worried about it. Snapchat emerged as an alternative to that, as a way to give people ephemeral, transient sort of communication. But it didn't work out too well for a variety of reasons. One is that Snapchat itself could keep some of these records. And the second is the users themselves can keep records of photographs by saving them as they're seeing them. So it's difficult to achieve ephemerality on the web.
It just seems like there's so many areas of our lives now that it's possible to have things that we would never intend to have public go public. So for instance, you know, pictures on our cell phones that we think, oh, well, this is just on my phone, or I just sent it to my partner or something like that. But, you know, is there a way for us to balance the all the wonderful windows that technology opens for us without putting ourselves at risk?
It's a hard question. It's a broad question and a hard question. You know, one interesting aspect of it that I like to think about a lot in my work is that maybe technology is making us all more honest, because there's traces of everything that we do. We give information away to others. Once we send somebody else a photograph, we no longer own it. Information is not privately owned anymore. So maybe in a way, people are more reluctant to deceive or to engage in behaviors that are negatively judged because there's all these records everywhere.
Well, Catalina, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Catalina Toma, Assistant Professor of Communication Science at UW-Madison, about the hacking and release of millions of users' personal information from the website AshleyMadison.com. You can continue the conversation on the Central Time Facebook page.